At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got all the essentials for comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style you can count on. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and effortless looks. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25.
Hey everybody, we got a great one today. You know, for a change, two writers for the Atlantic, not the Atlantic Monthly anymore, because their website changes all day, every day. So just the Atlantic. Our old friend Frank Foer, who's in the pantheon of great Franken guests, been on many times before, and Elena Plot Calabro, making her debut on the podcast. And talking today about an historic week in American history, the first African-American South Asian American to be the presidential nominee of a major political party, or any political party for that matter. Also, she's a woman, the second female nominee of a major political party. Vice President Kamala Harris is the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party, creating a lot of excitement. Raising $126 million in the first 4 days of her candidacy. As I record this on Friday morning, we are about to enter the seventh day of her campaign. I'm sorry I don't have the latest total, but maybe even more importantly, since President Biden withdrew from the race, Harris has closed the gap to one percentage point among likely voters in the New York Times Siena College poll in a head-to-head matchup with Donald Trump and leads him by 1 point when Robert Kennedy Jr. is included in the poll. So here we go. With about 100 days left in the campaign, it could not be closer. Of course, this will be won or lost in the battleground states, which still trend slightly toward Trump. I think the Times Siena poll didn't break that down. And I'll bet Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin are now toss-ups. So here we go. Meanwhile, I just want to say something about President Joe Biden, who withdrew from the race last Saturday and spoke to the nation on Wednesday evening. A painful speech for him, for sure. You know, as I listened to him, I was struck by what a consequential president he's been, achieving more in one term than any president really since LBJ, who in 1968, because of Vietnam, also withdrew from the presidential race. The pandemic relief bill, pulling the country out of a deep recession to sustainable growth, creating 16 million jobs, inoculating 230 million, over 70% of the American people, the biggest investment in infrastructure since the Eisenhower administration built the interstate highway system, the CHIPS Act, and the Inflation Reduction Act that, among other things, earmarked nearly $400 billion toward addressing climate change. And abroad, Biden restored the United States as the anchor of the free world while leading the successful effort to help Ukraine defend itself against Russian aggression. And as I heard him speak, I realized how glad I was that Biden had withdrawn from the race, because it was clear that, no denying it, he is just the wrong person to take on Donald Trump. Now, I'm sure there was a plus or minus 3% in the New York Times poll, but it appears that we now have a nail biter on our hands. And to discuss the race, we have Frank Foer and Elena Plot Calabro for a great one, you know, for a change. Frank, you wrote The Last Politician.
That's correct, yeah.
We've talked about that book, the first 2 years of the Biden administration. Elena, you did a profile of the vice president. You traveled with her to Africa and you interviewed her, what, how many times? Three times?
Three times. Mm-hmm.
So you're my experts, guys, today. Frank, why did it take so long for Biden to make this decision?
I mean, I think first, it's not very often that a one-term president decides to relinquish their claim on a second term. It's only happened in a small handful of times in American history that we could probably name. Hasn't happened since
Johnson,
LBJ.
Yeah. And that was in the middle of the Vietnam War.
And so it didn't feel like the normal order of things. But second of all, Joe Biden, I think in his head, was telling himself a story. I physically feel really good. I don't believe, you know, it makes me angry to hear all these people on television say that I'm not up to doing the job when I know I'm up to doing the job. He's a very, very proud guy. Scranton Joe does not like to be humiliated. And I think in his head, there was some humiliation associated with giving up the job and having it be stripped away from him in the way that it was ultimately stripped away from him. So he, every fiber in his being resisted it, except that at the end of the day, Joe Biden, as the title of my book implies, is a politician. One thing that politicians are exceedingly good at is counting noses. And he also, he responds to the opinions of other politicians. So he could see that there was this tidal wave that was about to be unleashed on him, where all these other members of the House and Senate were going to come out and say he shouldn't run. He could also see the way in which these politicians were saying, hey, you're screwing me. If you stick around at the top of the ballot, it's going to be terrible for me, you know, a couple clicks down.
And how much was he hearing this? How much was he hearing this from Pelosi and those? Was she the final straw? Or,
you know, I think that I don't know what the final straw was, but I think that there was, it was really just that there was this aggregation. But I think what you're implying in your question, if I'm reading you correctly, Al Franken, you know, he exists. I mean, I thought that the fact that he was in isolation with COVID at the very end when he made this decision was kind of metaphorically appropriate, because he just, his circle just kept shrinking smaller and smaller. It was no longer his wider circle of aides. It was these two guys, Mike Donilon and Steve Ricchetti. And then it was his family. And there was this terrible family dynamic where you had Hunter Biden, who is an addict, who's always known that he was, you know, the second most beloved Biden son, who had this chance to claim his father's love by mirroring back to his dad everything that his dad wanted to hear. It was a very, very bad dynamic.
What a surprise that Hunter created a bad dynamic in the family. It just seemed to me that it was obvious to everybody in the world before it was obvious to him.
That's the way it works. And especially with, just to generalize, you know, all these difficult conversations we have with our parents about the limits of what they can still do at their age are hard to do. And people resist those types of decisions because it implies mortality. And that makes them very hard conversations to have, hard conversations to accept.
Elena, how did Harris lock in the nomination so quickly?
I think in large part because she was a comparatively more sentient being who was immediately thrust forward as the option.
It took so long to get there.
Yeah.
That there was no real alternative, was there?
There was no real alternative. And I think that a lot of people in the party, and this is including people like Nancy Pelosi, who we kind of forget in all of the enthusiasm of this moment, but it was just last year that I can't remember who it was, which cable news host it was, but that person asked her, do you think Kamala Harris is the best choice for Biden's running mate for this second term? And she wouldn't answer the question. Jamie Raskin wouldn't answer that question either. So we've had, I mean, it's to me, it's felt like such whiplash going from prominent lawmakers, party leaders, not even wanting to attach their names to the idea of her just being the vice president again, to suddenly, yes, she is the best person possible for the Democratic nomination. But I think a lot of these people understood that 3 months is a very short period of time to introduce yourself to the American people. And so as much as people in the Beltway might be like, ah, Gretchen Whitmer or what have you, Americans don't know who Gretchen Whitmer is. With Kamala Harris, they might not know much about her vice presidency or whatnot, but at least she's somebody whose name they've seen in the news quite a bit.
Also, the idea that anyone could mount a campaign in the few weeks remaining before the convention.
Oh, fantasy. Yeah.
Well, it was a fantasy. The fact that everybody was questioning, I think it was over when he endorsed her, half an hour after he announced right. that he was leaving. My understanding is, I don't know where I read this. I read this somewhere that she made 100 calls in 10 hours.
That's right. Yeah. Or that's what her campaign says. Yeah. They, they sent out a feed.
Well, I bet you she did.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And look, I think this can't be overstated for a Democratic Party that has sort of just clamored for a glimpse of the president at times, like proof of life, it seems, you know, just the occasional television appearance or what have you. Kamala Harris is somebody who can actually barnstorm the campaign trail. We're not talking about an 8 p.m. bedtime anymore. And so to have somebody who, within hours of getting this nomination, is working phones, calling everyone, I mean, it just, the stark contrast to Joe Biden was such that I think that was just that such a swell of enthusiasm came from that.
And by the way, it's not just age with Joe Biden. Joe Biden just is incapable. He's always been incapable of having a short phone call. He's incapable of going in and having kind of a surgical speech. I mean, there's just age makes a lot of this stuff much, much worse, but his inefficiency is kind of baked into his temperament.
Elena, when did, in your profile, what, October or November of last year, had she begun to click with the issue of choice? It seems like that's the one that resonated for her and where she came into her own.
Absolutely. I think that's spot on. And I think that it really came about by happenstance. So I think that Joe Biden and a lot of his team really failed her is not really investing the time and energy into trying to understand how to sell her vice presidency to the American people from day one, how to promote her as a potential successor one day to kind of be the other end of that bridge. So she was sort of kind of aimless the first year and a half of her vice presidency. But then the Dobbs decision leaked. And suddenly you have this vacuum defined by a president who, as a devout Catholic, is not comfortable talking about abortion, certainly getting on the campaign trail and holding rallies around it. But you do have a vice president who is. And so, you know, for this person who had just really never really found her issue in this administration, all of a sudden she had one. And she really dove in head on. And we went into midterms, you know, polls, pundits, you know, expressing explicitly it would be a red wave. Voters would be voting according to their feelings about the economy. She really trusted her instincts in those moments. And I think really understood the salience of reproductive rights as an issue at the ballot box in a way that few other officials in Washington did. And I think her vindication on that front in midterm elections did a lot for her own confidence and sort of willingness to trust herself again, if that makes sense.
Can I ask a question now?
Yeah.
Just, Elena, you know, one of the things that's been so striking about the first 72 hours of the rollout of the Harris campaign is exactly what you're describing, which is she's got an ease, which I think a lot of us were not accustomed to seeing from the public Kamala Harris. Was that something that you were seeing as you were tracking her over the course of the last 18 months? Are you surprised by the candidate who's emerged?
No, I'm not. And for a few reasons. I mean, to Al's point, her claiming reproductive rights, I think, was the start, really, of the Kamala Harris that you see now. But I think also, I mean, she's an object lesson in timing, right? The reason that her 2020 campaign spectacularly collapsed was because she had no idea how to frame her background as a prosecutor in law enforcement to meet a moment when we're at the height of defund the police rhetoric.
It was a difficult time. This was the Floyd murder.
And so she came off as, you know, tremendously inauthentic because she just seemed unwilling to proudly claim her story. But we're in a moment where a lot of people are moving to the right on crime. Polls have are consistently showing that the past several months. And so the fact that she, you know, is in Wilmington on Monday and is leading with the fact that I'm a prosecutor, this is going to be the prosecutor versus the felon, I just think speaks to how so much has changed since she ran her first campaign for president.
And this is going to, her being a prosecutor is going to put the focus on Trump finally, because there's been really no focus on Trump, but all on Biden in the last month.
I completely agree. And it's what I think could make the debate between the two really interesting. And
he's agreed to it, right? I mean,
I actually don't know.
I don't think he has.
Like,
no.
Officially, oh. Yeah.
Oh, I think, yes, you're right. I think he said, I'm really eager to debate her, but he didn't say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did he put terms like Fox News would have to be the one to do it or something like that?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
He's left it ambiguous, trending towards no, but there's still some ambiguity.
Okay.
One thing that I think is just stunning in retrospect was that before this last week, when the torch was passed to a new generation, there was no Biden campaign. And that's what's so striking. It's not just, there was no message. There were no public appearances. There was I couldn't tell you, as somebody who wrote a book about Joe Biden, other than Democracy, Saving Democracy, what the fundamental campaign message was.
Well, he did make appearances, though.
But they were
teleprompter speeches. This was
either that or quite aimless. And he would get, when he would go off teleprompter, which he does quite a bit.
Well, he did the press conference on foreign policy. And that one, I thought that he expounded a lot on foreign policy in a way that felt like he was not stalling, but filling time.
Yeah, well, foreign policy is what he cares about and he loves doing. But you know, he'd start to talk about the economy at various stops. He just couldn't tell you exactly what his economic message was, even though I think he had a really good economic message to run on. He just wasn't capable of distilling it or spelling it out.
He mentioned the climate last night. Is this something that she can run on? I mean, it's hot this summer. Have you noticed? And I think Americans notice that. I'm just wondering if we can finally make climate an issue. I mean, Biden was losing young people, and I think she's already, what I see, is already getting them back.
And this has been ongoing. I think it was a year ago that she started her, what they called a Fight for Our Freedoms tour, which has been explicitly focused on college campuses, and climate has been a huge part of, you know, her appeal in those moments, talking about those issues. And it seems to have really resonated. I mean, I've gone to a few of those events and it's, you know, it's kids lining up for hours in advance of the event.
You know, as I said, can she use climate as an issue? The one that people care about is the economy. And you were saying, Frank, that he really wasn't selling his good record, the great record that this administration has had in terms of how many jobs is it? 16 million jobs. And people don't seem to remember what he inherited.
They really don't. I'm just kind of curious whether, I know COVID is like a complicated subject and people have a lot of resentments towards the way that the Biden people dealt with COVID. But if you were to go back and you were to point to an issue that was kind of catastrophically mismanaged, like one of the worst crises in modern America, and how did the White House respond?
And we're talking about the Trump White House.
Yeah. I mean, I just, nobody's going to want to hear it. But if you were going to illustrate the ways in which returning to Trump is inherently risky, I mean, to my ears, that's kind of the most persuasive example you could muster. I mean, he failed the country when they needed a president most.
Is it that people just don't want to think about that period now? Or what is it?
It's the recovery from COVID was so rocky. I think that there was this yearning for a very long time that there would be a binary moment with COVID where it would be COVID era and then we'd have a vaccine and it would be over.
Right.
And the vaccine saved, you know, amazing number of lives. And that's actually an incredible accomplishment of, you know, Trump gets a little bit of credit for it, but I think the lion's share of the credit goes to the Biden administration that within 6 months of their coming into office, you were able to walk into a CVS and get a life-saving drug that saved, I think the vaccine early in the first year, I think it saved something close to 1 million lives. It's one of the most successful government programs ever.
It's almost like proving a negative, though.
Well, yeah, but I think the truth of this goes beyond just the issue of COVID. It would be anything. I just think historically voters don't want to hear what you've done for them, but what you will do for them. And that feels like the moment we're in right now.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Biden's agenda for the Supreme Court, because he brought that up again last night. What is that's on ethics and
term limits potentially, right? Is it it's not totally clear what a reform agenda would look like, but I think term limits, interestingly and ironically, given his own decision to step away from power, I think is going to be one of the things that they're going to propose. Obviously, that has no shot at happening. So I think we're talking about an ethics agenda that has the best shot at materializing, but probably only a very, very limited shot. But I think what's important about Supreme Court reform is that you have Joe Biden, who is the essential institutionalist, who's over the arc of his career has been somebody who's revered the Supreme Court and tried to resist the polarization in the rest of the American political system from imposing itself on the way that the other branches dealt with the Supreme Court. So the fact that he's willing to go there seems to me an important first moment in building a longer term case for reforming the Supreme Court.
And that would be term limits. That's just not going to happen. That would require legislation, right? To do term limits in the Supreme Court.
And I don't know enough about this. It does not require a constitutional amendment, right? It's something that could be imposed.
But no majority is going to do that if they have the president and they have the majority and enough to confirm. And all you need is 50 and the vice president to confirm a Supreme Court justice. I don't see any administration voluntarily saying, okay, my appointment will have only 18 years. You know,
the spirit of nobility.
Okay, well, there is another campaign, that is the Trump campaign. And how are they reacting to this turn of events?
Well, not well is my first answer. Not even specifically within the Trump campaign, but a lot of the far right Twitter accounts, YouTubers who the Trump campaign courts assiduously to present their message is essentially, you know, undertaking all of the racist and misogynistic attacks that everybody predicted they would. So they are already playing to form in that respect. The Trump campaign, though, and I have a story about this today, is simultaneously going to try to paint Kamala Harris as too tough on crime, but also too soft. So when it comes to her tenure as Attorney General, they're going to point out that she did not pursue the death penalty for someone convicted of murdering a San Francisco police officer. The person got a life sentence, but they're going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. But then they're going to say that she also aggressively prosecuted marijuana offenses, that she, as Attorney General, championed a truancy law that ultimately led to some parents being incarcerated. So far, it's a pretty muddled message. What I think actually could end up being effective is the campaign and the RNC are already kind of, you know, feverishly pulling clips from her 2020 campaign when, like I mentioned earlier, she did just seem entirely aimless. Yes, eliminate private health insurance, decriminalize border crossings, just sort of this like, it's like she was just throwing things at the wall, seeing what could stick in the moment. You know, all that stuff has been captured for posterity. And I think that, you know, eventually Kamala Harris will have to address the differences between the platform that she's proposing now versus the person and platform she was proposing in 2020.
How does she get past that? It's like I when I saw some of these attack ads, I thought, man, I forgot how far left she was in 2019.
Frank, I honestly don't know.
Chris LaCivita, co-chair of the campaign? He did the Swift Boat ads, right? Against Kerry.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And he's really good at defining someone in a not even a true way, obviously. That's what the Swift Boats were. And that, I think, was decisive in that campaign. So I think that their campaign is going to hone in on her.
They will. I think what you're seeing now is a campaign as Franks and my colleague, Tim Alberta, has reported a lot, that had really put all their eggs in the Joe Biden basket and didn't actually expect him to drop out of the race. And so right now you see sort of a flailing, just given that there is a new nominee and they need to sort of restructure their strategy.
But they had an ad on right away.
They did. It's not like they had done no preparation whatsoever. It just, you didn't immediately have a coherent thing from the right-wing media space, not just from the Trump campaign itself.
I'm very interested to see, back to your first point about her being a prosecutor, the numbers that the Biden administration can point to on crime and border apprehensions are pretty strong, that they rebut a fundamental Republican attack. And you combine that with being a prosecutor, she could embrace those things. Or when Joe Biden wasn't really campaigning for reelection, he never pointed in the direction of those things. He let all the migration and crime slip by him as political issues.
I don't think this is a winning issue, though.
I was going to say, I don't think strategically she should be anywhere near the border. And that's what the Trump campaign is going to be all
over. I agree, but she can, in debates and et cetera, she can, in interviews, she can at least point that out.
But I think the response from Republicans is going to be, yeah, and in what way did you contribute to that? That's just how I see it playing out.
Well, she's been to the border
once, I think just once, right?
Well, that was her famous.
No, I know, but it was like right after that Lester Holt interview, she went to the border, which in itself was just optically terrible because it looked like she had just been pressured into it. But I don't think she's been again since then.
Well, she was handed some really difficult issues, including that, the border.
She wasn't technically handed the border.
Well, of course, it was the three Central America countries. But because of the Lester Holt interview, she kind of stepped in it big time.
And listen, this was not just sort of a media creation. Again, this goes back to Joe Biden, I think, often did really poorly by her. Joe Biden went to the Congressional Black Caucus shortly after he had given Kamala Harris this assignment. And he was the one saying, you know, I put Kamala Harris in charge of the border, and she has to sit there awkwardly and say, well, in fact, it's actually not quite just the border, but, you know, this more narrowly defined root causes issue. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, if the media ran off with the impression of her as the quote unquote border czar, Biden himself not only didn't do a lot to rein that in, but also sort of helped fuel it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Joe.
We did it, Joe.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with The Atlantic's Frank Foer and Elena Plot Calabro. So where's the polling now? What have you seen?
Well, we knew before Biden even dropped out of the race that in a head-to-head against Trump, Kamala Harris had overtaken him, which I do think was...
Overtaken Biden.
Yes, correct. Overtaken Biden. Was running ahead of Biden against Trump, which I think was part of the case that people like Nancy Pelosi were making to Biden at the very end as to why he should drop out. Frank, I don't know, have you seen any immediate polling in the past few days since his announcement?
Yeah, CNN has polling, and there's been a couple other lesser quality polls that have come out, and they have shown some movement to Harris, but it doesn't show her overtaking Trump. The CNN one went from Trump plus 6 over Biden to Trump plus 3 over Harris, which is not, it's not great.
No,
but
Harris,
it was within the margin of error, wasn't it?
It's an improvement, and I think, you know, the obvious qualifiers are that those poll numbers were also taken at the peak of Trump's popularity in the aftermath of the assassination and the convention, and that Trump's numbers generally are far higher than he's ever seen in his political career. You know, one expects that those will deflate a little bit, and also there's going to probably be multiple bumps for Harris along the way. That said, it feels to me like it's still a profoundly uphill climb for her.
Well, yeah. I mean, I just have no idea of what bumps along the way she might experience, because I wonder if she's also could be possibly at the peak of her polling, just in the excitement and energy around this kind of honeymoon phase.
Well, she's going to have to sustain this.
Yeah. Like I don't, what happens when that inevitably starts to dim?
She's got a couple other plot points in her future that'll be, so she's going to pick a vice president. She's going to have a convention.
I like the way you said that. Like you were writing the novel and we were just, you know, here.
Yeah. Well that sets it up before the twist that, exactly.
Well, who will she pick for vice president? I mean, it's a stunning bench. My choice is Kelly.
Kelly.
Yeah. From Arizona.
Why is he your choice?
He's an astronaut.
let's hope, Al, that he's not an empty spacesuit.
Ooh. Mm. Okay, let's sit on that for a while.
All right, no.
An empty spacesuit. Oh God. Anyway. No, he's not. I mean, I think he's great. That's why. It's not just that he's an astronaut. It's just that I think he's great on his feet. I've seen him interviewed many times. But there are a lot of other great. My governor, Tim Walz. Tim Walz is one of the people, the governor of Bashir of Kentucky. A lot of people being.
I noticed you skipped Whitmer and Shapiro there.
Well, I shouldn't. I think Whitmer would be two women running. And let me explain why I think that might not work. And Shapiro. You know, Pennsylvania is one of the must wins, right? Is the must win.
Yeah.
With Michigan and Wisconsin.
Yep.
Can we talk about Shapiro for 1 second? I saw John King reporting on CNN that, you know, the potential problem with picking Shapiro is that he's Jewish.
Really?
And that and it was just sort of he's Jewish, full stop. And I just found that so bewildering. And then it was Jewish, but then it became Zionist. But this was being presented as, you know, straight reporting as a potential pitfall of, you know, his candidacy. And I just thought, have we entered the twilight zone? Like, how did we get here?
I wrote a cover story for The Atlantic explaining.
He did, actually. It was really wonderful. It was basically, how did we get here?
Yeah, we had you on, actually, Frank, to talk about the end of the golden age of American Jewry.
But I do think that your point about Shapiro is a good one, which is that, you know, I think in maybe even in certain elite circles, because the way in which Gaza has polarized so much opinion, and there's like this jumping to overstate kind of the perils of picking somebody who's an observant Jew and the way in which anti-Zionism would, or which manifests itself in anti-Semitism, would somehow derail Democratic enthusiasm for Josh Shapiro, which I don't actually think would really be the case.
Well, no one really knows him. So, you know, this is an untested theory.
I just couldn't get over how plainly it was reported. Like, well, he has, you know, not a great position on the Green New Deal. He's Jewish. There's like, and along down the list. And it's like, what?
Those are both big issues. Well, it's, speaking of Gaza, we had Netanyahu speak yesterday. Did you watch that? I imagine, Frank?
Yeah, I did. I mean, as a commentary in the way in which the American political system by and large is disconnected from debates that happen on op-ed pages and in college campuses. It was quite a contrast. I mean, Netanyahu is an incredibly polarizing figure and somebody who is widely detested. I think Pelosi, who is a real Zionist and been one, a lifelong Zionist, wouldn't attend, and she expressed her disdain for him. Schumer, of course, had called for Netanyahu to step down. There was a very awkward moment where Netanyahu, as he was strolling into the house, walked past Schumer and
Schumer nodded.
Shake his hand. Yeah, and Netanyahu was stone cold in his face. But, I mean, essentially, Netanyahu came in and gave a Netanyahu speech and got lots of standing ovations. And I don't think that that reflects American political opinion writ large, but it reflects kind of a bipartisan consensus basically on Capitol Hill. And there is some disconnect. I think it was pretty stunning that Kamala Harris wasn't there.
She's meeting with him today.
She's meeting with him today, and Biden's meeting with him today. And of course, this is going to be the work for the rest of the Biden administration, that Biden is going to do everything he can to push the war in Gaza to an end, and then to try to push diplomacy for what the post-war will look like in terms of the reconstruction of Gaza, having Arab states pay for the reconstruction of Gaza, and then potentially going for a Saudi normalization deal, which becomes either his legacy or a legacy that he shares with the next president.
How can Gaza possibly be governed? And I mean, what does that look like after a ceasefire? And
well, you saw earlier this week, Hamas and the PLO, so the Palestinian Authority, essentially entered into an agreement where they would be able to jointly govern Gaza together.
Would that be acceptable to Netanyahu? Would that be acceptable to Israel?
That's not the Netanyahu plan, but obviously. But the problem is that Hamas is a political movement, and it's a military movement. If the military movement of Hamas continues to exist, that's understandably, justifiably a problem for the Israelis. But if you were able to have a demilitarized Islamist Muslim Brotherhood oriented movement that you can call Hamas or you can call something else, it does reflect a chunk of political opinion in Palestinian politics. And rather than have that opinion get channeled into militias, you would rather have it get channeled into
governing,
into politics, into political parties, etc.
I just don't see that happening. And I think that's...
It's like terrorist rehab. Like, is that really going to happen? I don't know. It seems really idealistic.
The problem is that there is no alternative. The alternatives in Gaza are anarchy, Israeli occupation, or you could have... in the short term, you're going to have some sort of international occupation, possibly.
That would be like financed by Saudi Arabia and others in the region.
Yes.
So that would be sort of Arab governed area.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I don't think any of the details have really been worked out by anybody in any sort of plausible sort of way. So
you're still working on that part of the novel of how that gets worked out. Yeah.
So on Biden, back to him, the speech. It was very wistful. His voice is still weaker. I mean, it was clear from that speech that he was making the right decision. That's for sure.
I just watched it knowing how hard it was for him to get to that point and knowing how hard it was for him to go through this process. And you could see the ways in which, as he was explaining his decision, he was both explaining it to the country and explaining it to himself, that he was convincing himself of the nobility of what he had done. And that in order to take the edge off of what I think he probably feels is a humiliation, he was able to reposition it all as a great act of patriotism. And he elided the fact that he should have done this months earlier, but never mind.
a year earlier.
But he obviously, he still has a country to govern. Do you get the sense, Frank, that there's any dimming of motivation in that respect? Or what is that actually going to look like?
I think it's actually he's more motivated to have some accomplishments, right?
Yeah, I buy that. But I also think it's just harder when, we just took the example of trying to negotiate an end to the war. When it's obvious you're not going to be the president, there's no doubt about it. He's not going to be the president beyond January. It's easier to wait him out. And so that's always an inherent problem with lame ducks. And
Netanyahu would rather have Trump.
I don't even know if that's totally true, but it's possible. It's true?
I believe it's true.
I think Netanyahu would certainly rather have a speaker Mike Johnson.
Obviously, he'd rather have Trump than Kamala Harris, because Harris is to Biden's left. A lot of leaders who we think are in love with Trump also appreciate that he is
Not the president.
Well, he's also mercurial and arbitrary, and he can turn on you at any moment. Like, I've looked into this as it relates to Saudi Arabia and to Israel. And I think both of those countries, who everybody says are in lockstep with Trump, are able to transactionally deal with Trump in an effortless sort of way because whatever, they know how to deal with a dictatorial type of figure.
Give his son-in-law $2 billion.
Yeah, but on the other hand, his arbitrariness and capriciousness makes him somebody who's unnerving to even them.
Okay, you guys, thank you so much.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you. Great to talk to you. This was so much fun.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.